Hello and welcome to another episode of Living with Dying. I'm joined today by palliative care nurse Louisa Nicol. Now, you came across the podcast on LinkedIn, I think, didn't you, Louisa? And it sparked an interest in you because I think you feel the public doesn't have a very good understanding about palliative care. So we've got a lot to talk about.
I have indeed. We do.
Tell me about your experience.
So my interest in palliative care came back years ago. I did my nurse training in London, qualified in 1991, and my first ward was actually an oncology ward. And I really loved that element of the care of, you know, patients coming in. You got to know the patients because they come back in for more treatment, and really had that sort of feeling of total patient care, I would say. And knew that that was sort of the area I wanted to go into. And when I, during that time, I met who would then become my husband, John, and we moved out to Berkshire. And actually, when I looked at my next job, there was a hospice that had been opened recently. And so I took a job as a staff nurse in a hospice and then went on to become a team leader there. And I think it's there that my sort of real passion for palliative care came through, that this was the type of nursing that I wanted to be involved in. And continued that throughout my career. I had a career break when my children were younger, but I've worked in all settings. So I was a hospital clinical nurse specialist. I've been a community clinical nurse specialist. I've worked in day hospice, which was actually my favourite role of all, I think, within the community setting. And then in 2015, I became the ward manager of a local 12-bedded hospice. And sadly, around that time, my husband, who was 50 at the time, was diagnosed with osteosarcoma. So at that point, my professional and personal life really did collide in a way that we would never have expected, to be fair.
So, gosh, that must have been a shock. You'd been so busy looking after other people in the end stages of life, and suddenly you're faced with doing it with your own husband.
Yeah, and I mean, at the beginning, we didn't think it was going to be like that. Obviously, he actually had about 4 years of very aggressive treatment, including he had 9 operations in total. He had 4 cycles of chemotherapy, and interestingly, the same chemotherapy that I was giving to patients back in the 1990s. The treatments haven't really moved on in some areas in all of that time. It's such a rare cancer, and it's really, doesn't really sometimes get the research and the funding that that's needed. So the treatment he had was mostly surgical. When he did have recurrence, he, in 2018, so 2 years after he was diagnosed, he actually had his right leg amputated. But throughout all of this, he was incredible. He was working as a police surveillance trainer, and whenever he could get back to work full time, he was working full time. And we juggled our lives with our 2 children who were teenagers when he was diagnosed. I continued to work at the hospice, although I did go part time just so that I could be around a bit more to support him and with hospital appointments and the children as well. So we sort of carried on in a strange way, adjusting to this new life that we had, which was just, you know, quite taken up with hospital appointments and visits and, you know, lots of consultations. And but we did it, and we still managed to have a very good life. And then in 2019, we had the news that following a routine scan, that he had lung metastases. But the options at that point were to have further surgery. So he had 9 hours of surgery. And following that, the consultant spoke to us after the surgery. He was due to have further lung surgery. And he spoke to us and said, actually, that further surgical intervention wouldn't be in his best interest. And that palliative chemotherapy was the option at this point. John had always said that he wouldn't have chemotherapy again if his life depended on it. He found the side effects very, very hard to tolerate. He had side effects that affected his kidney, so he ended up having, you know, under another consultant for this sort of knock-on from the side effects of the treatment. But yet, when we were in this oncology waiting room, consulting room, when he's the only options being offered to him, he signed the consent form without a lot of discussion. He was told at the time that his prognosis would be up to 12 months without chemotherapy and 12 to 18 months with it. And we came home and we had to tell the children and our family and John's family in Scotland and get our heads around the news as well as more treatment. And then one day he said to me, a few days after we came back from the hospital, he said, I'm only having this for you and the children. If I had a choice in this, I wouldn't have it. And from there, I probably had my nurse hat on as well as my wife hat on. And we sat down, we talked a lot about what that really meant and what did his choice mean at this point. And I said, you do have a choice. You do have a choice. You don't have to have the treatment. And we looked and we sat down and there's a very good acronym of BRAM, which is the benefits, the risks, the alternatives, and to do nothing. And it's used in healthcare, but I don't think it's used widely enough within the public domain. And we really sat down ourselves and we talked about what the benefits and the risks were. And actually, the benefits of potentially 6 months additional living or life didn't feel that it sat well with what that would mean for those 6 months in terms of more hospital treatment, more side effects, more risks of infection. And actually, when we looked at what the benefits of not having the treatment, it was coming up for our daughter's 18th birthday. It was coming up for Christmas, which was likely to be our last Christmas together, New Year. He wanted to see his family in Scotland whilst he was well. We wanted to go on holiday. And we wrote a list, and it wasn't a decision that was made lightly. I do want to point that out. It's not a decision that everybody would want to make, but it was the one that we made. And it was the right decision for us. We had a very good few months together. You know, I've been in palliative care now for, a number of years. And I think that the conversations are still not happening when they should be happening around what the expectations of treatment and what the disease is looking like. And I read a really interesting article, and I've become quite interested in an expression called time toxicity. And it's around, the amount of times that people, particularly in the last months of life, spend getting up early in the morning to get to a hospital appointment, to sit in a waiting room, to have an appointment, to really, does it make a lot of difference to the quality of their life, or is it extending their life by days or weeks? And it may be good for them to think about that and, sort of prioritising, as I say, what matters to them. And maybe, I do like the expression, adding life to your days remaining rather than days to life. And certainly with John, we had, some very, very special memories created. And I think him having the opportunity to have his head clear from hospital appointments and scans and waiting for scan results, in that time, he wrote letters and cards to myself and the children. He actually wrote cards to our friends as well, because he just had that space, I think, to acknowledge what was happening, but it didn't overwhelm us. He would just, because we had a lot of time, because it was lockdown, so he would just sit in the study and he would just, write things. And he wrote an 18-page life story, and he wrote me a what to do guide to, all of our accounts and insurance details. And it really was him preparing us, leaving his legacy for us when he knew what was happening. And we didn't talk a lot about him dying. We did talk about what we were doing with him living at that time. So, and we've, as I say, we've got some lovely memories of that time. And when John and I were talking about what I would do for work after he died, he said, I think you'll go and share our story. And you'll make it known that it is possible to live well when you're dying. And so I've spent many, many years since he died trying to really get that across to people, because I think it's really important.
I'm particularly struck by your use of that phrase "bran," which I was introduced to by Dr. Lucy Pollock, the amazing geriatrician that I interviewed recently. She introduced me to that, and it's so helpful. And it's, I've actually noticed myself bearing it in mind for my, me and my friends and family, because you do want to know, and you don't get told by doctors. You might get told the benefits of something. You never get told the risks, or the risk of doing nothing. Yeah. And it would be helpful if we were all included in that.
Yeah, and interestingly, because I do find it really, again, interesting, what if the information is out there for the public to help them? And actually, there's a very lovely poster explaining what BRAN is, which is a patient information poster. There's also a patient information form where you can, it's four speech bubbles and you can complete it. But to my knowledge, I've never seen it out in a public setting, in a hospital, in a GP surgery. Most people I talk to have never heard about it. And I think what's also really good about BRAN, I spoke to somebody that works in public health, and they said actually it's something you can apply to any part of your life. And I thought that was quite interesting, because, you know, we're not good at talking about death. Nobody wants to do that. Nobody wants to, you know, have that conversation. But actually, it is the one thing that we all know that is going to happen. And actually not talking about it doesn't make it not happen. In fact, not talking about it can make it much harder for everybody. You know, I was part of a community event a few weeks ago, and actually we set up an event with it was led by a funeral celebrant who had found it very frustrating to go to people's homes after someone had died and the families not know anything about what their wishes might be for their funeral. And she had this idea of bringing together a financial estate planner and a funeral director herself. And I went along as well with the lived experience and the clinical perspective. And 85 people turned up on a Tuesday night, and 100% of people said that they felt it was a really helpful evening and would recommend it to people. So I think what I got from that is that people want to have these conversations. They want to understand more. And I think that that is the way forward. I see sometimes, you know, there's lots of medical study days. I've spoken at medical conferences and about our lived experience and, you know, what that was like to make that decision. But sometimes I just think maybe we need a study day for the public, so that they are as well informed about what they want to. And, you know, 85 people turning up in a village on a Tuesday night, I think says quite a lot about the interest that there is in this, and that people do want to be equal partners in their care, rather than, you know, having things done to them. So I definitely feel that that is going to be something that will be interesting to see if we can do more of that as well.
Because if we don't do it, and then we're faced with somebody dying, we're floundering, aren't we? We're at a loss to know what's going to be best, which way to turn, what we should do.
Yeah, and I used it the night that I was I presented at this community event. I said, you know, the communication is a little bit like, you know, knocking on a door gently and just seeing how far you can get in with the first bit of information. And that might be something practical around your will or your LPA, and just making sure that that's in place. A lot of people that were in that room that evening hadn't got lasting power of attorneys sort of in place. But if that was the only thing they took away from them that night, that's a huge start in terms of their future care. If they took away the fact that actually I need to talk to my family a little bit more about what I would like in terms of my priorities, that was great as well. But my feeling was that everybody went away with something, that there will be a ripple effect to that. And I said, you know, this tapping on the door gently, see how far you let in, opposed to somebody in the back of an ambulance or in a A&E corridor having to barge in and have this conversation that's very hard to have everything in one go in a situation that's often, you know, a crisis and people are in a lot of distress. And I don't think it has to be one conversation. I think it's something that just should become part of what we do. And in my life now, you know, sadly I know a lot of widows, and I say sadly in the wrong way, because they're actually the the amazing people that I've met, but a lot of them in the same age group as me. So we're not talking about having these conversations because people are in their older years. Actually, you know, people die suddenly, having some things in place. I confessed, you know, John was a police officer, probably at high risk at times. We didn't have things in place before he was diagnosed, but I would be a very strong advocate for people to do that now. And actually, if you have it and you have it gently in a situation where it's not so, doesn't feel so scary to have, it's done and you put it away and then you carry on living until you need to revisit it maybe. And then again, with the, you know, and, you know, if you do know that you've got a serious life limiting illness, that is when you should be having those conversations about what's important with your families and with your clinicians.
So let's talk about John again now. You say he died at home. Was that his wish? Was that your choice? How did that happen?
Well, I think, again, a bit of lockdown happened with that choice. So he had always said that he didn't want to die at home. He didn't want the memories in the house of him dying to be here with me and the children. And so he talked about being in a hospice, but having worked in a hospice, I know that actually people really go into hospice because they've got difficult symptoms to manage, or, you know, there are care breakdown issues and they need that round, you know, that more of that support. And part of me as a palliative care nurse and a wife felt that I could do that for him at home, but I also respected the fact that what he was saying about the, you know, the future. But then when lockdown happened, we had another conversation about it, and he made it very clear. We had he had a respect form, which you know, I don't think that's necessarily a national document, but it's a summary basically of what emergency treatments you would want if an emergency happened. And he made it very clear he didn't want to go to hospital, particularly being in lockdown, because you couldn't have any visitors in there. And he knew that once he went in there, he had some underlying cardiac issues that they probably would start trying to fix other things that actually, you know. So he made it clear that he didn't want to go to hospital. And when the lockdown happened, we then talked about the hospice, and he said, but I don't want to be somewhere that, you know, I can't have visitors. And so we made the decision that, you know, that for as long as we could, he would be at home. And actually, I still do have this feeling that because things were so much calmer, because we didn't have the crisis, that actually he did. I mean, I saw him changing in the last few weeks where he was more fatigued, but we were sort of organised people to come around that, and he was more breathless. That we managed the symptoms as well as we could do. And the day before he died was actually our 26th wedding anniversary, and he managed to come down. We had a stair lift, which was actually really helpful, because we didn't have to make the choice about having a bed downstairs. And I think that's a very big, for me, that's quite a big thing. So he did manage to come downstairs that day. And then it was, you know, relatively peaceful, quite a bit, not quicker than I thought, but actually I think if he'd been in bed with a pair of pyjamas on, looking like a patient, people wouldn't have been surprised that he died when he did. But he tried so hard to maintain his dignity and his identity. So he would come down and he was dressed and he would be on the sofa and still engage in family life as much as he could. So I think it was a surprise to a lot of people, the way that sort of happened. But he did live literally until the day before he died. So and myself and our children and my sister were with him when he died. The palliative care team had been out in the morning. It did highlight to me some of the issues around community services, because there was a breakdown in community services that I called in the morning because I knew he wouldn't be able to take his oral medication, and the night shift had finished at 7 p.m. at 7 a.m. and the day staff didn't start till 8. And you know, when you've been with somebody all night waiting to sort of the morning to come, not having someone be able to come to you, you know, sort of fairly quickly was quite difficult. But the palliative care team came out, and they were very good. And he died peacefully in our own bed. The hospital bed was being delivered that morning as that was happening. So he didn't end up in the hospital bed. So it was. I think for me, having worked again in palliative care and seen so many people's deaths within a setting where things are expected and where things have been talked about, I do believe that a death can certainly be a lot more peaceful than when it happens unexpectedly, in terms of the conversation hasn't happened. And when that sort of knowledge that this is coming isn't always there, or it's known by people, but it's not communicated clearly enough. I think that's the other thing, is about how it's communicated, using the words to make it clear to people when somebody is deteriorating. I think because of the way that he had approached his life, I think it was sort of how that impacted on his death as well.
And how much would you say your knowledge, your background, your career, your experience was helpful in those last few days? Because I have to say, I have a concern about people saying they want to die at home without knowing what services are available to them.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that it certainly was something that I think helped a lot. I think even around things like he did become quite breathless at times, but being able to manage that because I'd seen it before, and I was there. I think symptoms like that can be very scary, and I can see how people would then, you know, call an ambulance, and even if they wanted to be at home, they would think this person's, you know, is so breathless they're going to die. I think again, it's one of those things that, you know, some people do want to die at home, and but I think what we expect of the general public to care for somebody at home is actually enormous. Again, different services coming in, different pieces of equipment, how to move somebody well, services, you know, I worked in a hospice at home service up until about a year ago, and which is, you know, it is a great service. We don't have a local hospice now. That the hospice was closed, I think it was 2019. So the hospice at home service is there, but, you know, it really is only 3 hours of care a day. It's three visits a day, you know, an hour in the morning, an hour at lunchtime, and an hour in the evening. It's not 24 hours. Those evening hours are very, very hard. I think that, again, with my sort of public awareness hat on, which I feel is where I'm going a bit more with this now, is, you know, a little bit more, I don't want to use the word training because it's not that, but just a little bit more understanding of what is expected from a care person, a husband, a wife, a daughter, a son, to also try to remain in that role as well. Because I think things become very, very difficult or very different very quickly in a time when, you know, time is precious, and you want that time to be quality time. And actually, if you're stressed by the care, but also making sure you've done the care right, I think there's a lot of people caring for people wanting to do the right thing but not knowing, because it's not been their job. That, you know, I've done that job for 30 years. Most of my friends worked in that field. I could call on people for advice and for help. And it, again, you know, this whole thing about a new language, it's a whole new role, isn't it, for somebody? And often people are still working and doing that role, and I've got children at home and providing that care. So I think I mean, for me, having worked in all palliative care settings, I've actually now I've added hospice at home to my brief, but I do feel that I completely understand about hospices closing and because of the, you know, lack of funding, but I really do feel that a hospice option should be available to people that want it. I think that it's something that for some people, I think somebody dying at home could have enormous effects on their bereavement outcomes and how that death has occurred. And, you know, one of my sort of famous favourite quotes is, you know, how the things Dame Cecily Saunders, you know, how someone dies remains in the memories of those who live on. And as I say, from my situation now, meeting other widows and widowers, you know, I can really feel that, you know, that the sense that sometimes they feel that they didn't get to do what they wanted to do because they were so busy caring or worrying about what they were doing. So, you know, I mean, for my part, you know, I feel that hospice care should certainly be funded as maternity care and other services are as well. It's a process that we're all going to go through, and I think that it really should be given a little bit more funding to make that happen.
Thank you so much for talking to me, Louisa. There's some real words of wisdom there, and I hope people get a lot of benefit from listening to you, because you're full of good advice. And like you said earlier on, we're all going to go through it, aren't we? And A, we need to make plans, but B, we also want to make sure their plans are the right ones.
Yeah,
for us, absolutely. And our relatives.
Definitely. Thank you very much.
Death is never easy, but there are ways we can help each other through it. And if you've found any of these episodes helpful, please think about liking and sharing. And if you can help spread the word by telling just one other person, thank you. And a huge thanks to Joe Barrett, without whom these podcasts would simply not be possible. You can contact us on hello@livingwithdying.co.uk.